Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's been really nice to fill up the tank for less than $2 a gallon recently, but OPEC doesn't see it that way. Lower prices for us mean lower profits for them. So today they cut production. Didn't do them much good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, the 17th of December. Today, OPEC announced a record cut in oil output, 2.2 million barrels per day beginning January 1st. That, coupled with another earlier cut, means cartel members will be pumping almost 5% less oil than a year ago. But if they're really looking to jack up prices, why not cut even more? Especially when today's announcement did nothing but send those prices even further south. Here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
OPEC's target price for a barrel of crude is $75, and today you could get a barrel for just over $40. Even though the production cut is the largest in its history, OPEC, for now at least, has lost control over the price of oil, says Deloitte analyst Joseph Stanislaw.
Demand is in a free fall. What's driving demand right now is not the price of oil. What's driving demand is the global economy. And that's in free fall as well. Until we know when the global economy turns around, we won't know when oil demand turns around.
More evidence today that demand will continue to drop. The Energy Department reported oil and gasoline reserves in the U.S. are up over the past week. And then there's market skepticism that OPEC members are disciplined enough to stick with their production cuts. Fareed Mohammadi with PFC Energy says oil producers grew dependent on the income from triple-digit prices for oil and set their budgets accordingly. Now there's a lot of internal bickering over production levels.
You know, Rome was burning in a sense while OPEC was siddling. Now I think it's going to take a little bit of convincing to turn it around and show that OPEC is serious, and the market will be watching very carefully if the new quotas are met.
If OPEC members cut production too much, they risk starving the world economy into a steeper downturn. Not enough, and the oversupply will keep their commodity cheap and bring less profit. For now, falling oil prices are giving the Federal Reserve the inflation protection it needs to keep interest rates near zero. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Perhaps the only thing falling fast enough in the last 24 hours to catch the price of a barrel of oil was the dollar. After the Fed's surprise rate cut announcement yesterday, the dollar dropped dramatically against key foreign currencies. It now stands at a 13-year low against the yen, and it's back to early October lows against the euro. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story from New York.
The financial crisis sent investors fleeing to the safety of the dollar, a currency that is still the most accepted note in international business. But now that the Fed has exhausted its rate-cutting option, the most likely route on the road to economic recovery is quantitative easing, basically flooding the market with dollars. And that isn't good for the value of the greenback.
I think it's very simply about yield. Unless there is a yield on a currency, there is no point in holding it, and the dollar's yield has virtually disappeared.
Howard Wieldon is a senior strategist at BGC Partners in London. He says there's also a general lack of faith in the U.S. economy among currency traders. As for the dollar's big drop against the euro since yesterday,
the sustainability of borrowing in most euro countries is seen as quite acceptable compared to that of the U.S. and indeed the U.K.
Fast rising debt in the UK is keeping the British pound low after falling from $2 to $1.50 since August. Meanwhile, Japan's trade surplus is making the yen more attractive to nervous investors, says Brian Dolan, chief currency strategist for Gain Capital.
Also, you have from the Ministry of Finance in Japan indications that they will not intervene to prevent the yen from strengthening further.
But currency experts warn the boost in the yen and the euro may be temporary. They say while a weakening of the dollar is an ugly side effect, the U.S. economy may well be the first to rebound from the global slump because of the Fed's current efforts. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Today, alleged Ponzi scheme mastermind Bernie Madoff made an appearance in federal court in Manhattan. Madoff was fitted with an ankle monitor after the judge altered previous requirements that he get four people to co-sign his $10 million bail bond. He could only get two, his wife and his brother, to vouch for him. Meanwhile, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission is now asking the same question so many others have asked over the last several days. How can you miss a $50 billion fraud? It's just the latest high-profile mistake made by the SEC, and Chairman Christopher Cox launched an internal probe. Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us there are many more investigations to come.
Since 1999, would-be whistleblowers have been complaining to the SEC staff about Bernie Madoff, according to SEC Chairman Christopher Cox.
Credible allegations about Mr. Madoff had been made over nearly a decade, and yet never referred to the commission for action.
Cox called this a grave failure, and he's asked the SEC Inspector General to investigate what went wrong.
Law enforcement is at the heart of what the SEC does. It's why I have made enforcement a priority during my chairmanship.
But earlier this year, Cox turned down greater powers.
I came out of the enforcement division. He did little to support us and much to throw obstacles in our path.
James Kaufman is the former assistant director of enforcement at the SEC.
You only have to look at his history on the Hill to see that he's been a staunch deregulator and a foe of investor rights.
Kaufman says under Cox's leadership, politically appointed commissioners have made it more difficult to initiate investigations or negotiate settlements, and that morale at the enforcement division has never been worse. Arthur Levitt, who ran the SEC from 1993 until 2001, says change at the top is long overdue. But
I think anybody that has been in a leadership position at the commission bears some responsibility
for what may be the biggest fraud in American history. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
In Boston today, the company that was charged in the fatal collapse of a Big Dig tunnel ceiling agreed to pay $16 million to settle the case. In exchange, the attorney general dropped manslaughter charges. The company also promised to make sure it uses the right glue next time. Yesterday, investors loved that three-quarter point rate cut by the Fed. Today, not so much. The Dow finished down 100 points. Details when we do the numbers. You've got exactly 2 weeks to get your finances in order, at least when it comes to what you'll end up paying Uncle Sam. December 31st is fast approaching, so we've brought in Tom Herman, tax columnist for The Wall Street Journal, to give us a few helpful hints on reducing the tax bite. Hello, Tom.
Thanks, Tess. Good to be with you.
You know, so many people have lost so much money this year. Do you think there's any chance the IRS might just say, oh, that's all right, keep your money?
No, I don't think so.
That's
one of the few predictions. Now I feel very comfortable making that prediction. But there is still plenty of time to take some steps to cut your taxes without having the IRS doing anything differently than in the past.
All right, well, let's talk about that. What kinds of year-end strategies should they be employing to get at least a little help from Uncle Sam?
Take a look at what's left of your investments in your taxable accounts. Take a look in particular at the investments that have gone down in value. If you were thinking of selling some of those anyway, now is a very good time to consider pulling the trigger. You can use your losses to offset your gains on a dollar-for-dollar basis, and there's no limit on that. But there's one other very important rule that a lot of readers I've found do not know about. Suppose your losses are even bigger than your gains. You can sell those losers and deduct up to $3,000 of your net losses each year from your wages and other ordinary income. And that's why a lot of investors I know who have big losses are arranging their affairs right now so that they have a $3,000 net loss and therefore can reduce their taxes for 2008.
Here's another very complicated twist that I wonder if you could help us sort through this. I've been reading that with some mutual funds, you could actually find yourself subject to capital gains even if you've taken big hits.
Absolutely. And this amazes investors when they find this out. You could have invested in a mutual fund that's down 40 or 50% this year, and you could still get a capital gains distribution from that fund. And a lot of people can't figure out why that is.
I'm among them. So help us out.
The basic reason is that a lot of mutual funds sold stocks much earlier in the year when prices were much higher because they wanted to move to a different type of stock or they just thought that stock was heading down. So they have these built-in capital gains and they didn't want to sell later. So they may have big capital gains distributions that they're paying out. Mutual funds are required by law to make these capital gains distributions.
And what we're talking about here is taxable accounts, right? This does not affect 401ks, IRAs, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. This is only for your taxable accounts. And I should have mentioned earlier that you can't deduct losses in your retirement accounts. These are only for taxable accounts.
Is there any relief for the hundreds of thousands of people who have watched their property values plummet? Anything in the tax code that can help those folks?
Unfortunately, you cannot take a loss on the sale of your home. That surprises a lot of people. A lot of people think of their home as their primary investment.
Right.
But that does not count. That capital loss I told you about of the $3,000 a year in most cases, that's on securities. It does not count your primary residence, I'm afraid.
Tom Herman is the tax columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for coming in and happy holidays.
Thanks, Tess. You too.
Earlier, we mentioned OPEC is cutting oil production in an effort to boost prices. Well, 6 months ago, you could have counted on one hand the number of people predicting that a barrel of light crude would cost around $40. Back then, oil traders were paying well north of $100 a barrel on the oil futures markets. And there's the rub. Those traders weren't actually buying barrels of oil and wheeling them home. They were paying what they thought a barrel of oil would cost at some point in the future, which is why they're called futures. Yes, it's confusing, but here to help us figure it all out is Marketplace's Rico Galliano with the latest installment of The Marketplace Decoder.
Okay, let's jump right in with a definition. It comes from Jeff Carter. He's an independent speculator and a former director of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
A future is merely a contract where the buyer agrees to buy a commodity and the seller agrees to sell a commodity at a specified price sometime in the future.
He's laughing because, yes, this is a financial instrument with a name that actually makes sense. I know, incredible. But just to make sure you understand futures, let's dramatize the transaction, which we'll do, ironically, by taking a trip to the past.
Futures have been around forever. Chinese traded them back in 1100, rice futures.
At least there's some evidence they go back that far. So via the magic of radio, let's imagine what might have gone down in a Chinese rice paddy, circa 1100.
Hello, I'm a Chinese rice farmer.
Hey, nice paddy.
Yeah, it's pretty swank, but I'm a little worried, man.
Why is that, dude?
Because there's way too much rice in the market these days. When harvest rolls around, I'm just praying I can sell enough to cover expenses.
I tell you what, I will promise right now to buy half your rice once it's harvested. On that day, I'll pay you 2 copper pieces a ton.
Sweet. That'll cover my expenses with money left over to take the wife to Vegas.
Vegas doesn't exist yet, but whatever. And you know what? I think rice is going to sell for more than 2 copper pieces, so I figure I'm locking in a super cheap price.
Hey, let's write this down in a contract.
Genius! And scene. So there you have it. Farmer gets a guaranteed sale. Buyer locks in a potentially low price. Now, in today's futures markets, traders buy and sell contracts for everything from rice to oil. They don't plan on ever actually touching those commodities. But by trading the contracts, they can gamble on where they think prices are headed. Kevin Kerr is editor of Global Commodities Alert.
If you think it's going higher, you want to buy the futures. If you think that oil will go lower, then you can sell it. So you really have to decide which way you think it's going ahead of time and then place your bet.
That can be risky. Just check out the wild swings in oil futures lately. Kerr says the government may start enforcing rules that could calm the market, though, which I guess means regulation is the future of futures. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Coming up, an undocumented entrepreneur who's determined to work in America.
You know, there's a lot of people, they make documents and we buy them, and that's the only way you can work. I mean, it's not legal, but what can you do?
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors gave back some of yesterday's gains as the oil prices fell today. The Dow dropped 0.1%, 99 points, to close at 8,824. The Nasdaq lost 2/3, 10 points, to finish at 1579. And the S&P closed down nearly 1%, 8 points, to 904. Oil companies dripped lower as crude dropped to around $40 a barrel. ConocoPhillips slid 1.3%. ExxonMobil slipped 2.5%. Financial firms continued to gain ground. Morgan Stanley chalked up a 2.25% gain, even though the company announced it lost more than $2 billion in the last quarter. Goldman Sachs, meanwhile, gained another 3.75% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.19%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff gives year-end remarks about the department's accomplishments at Georgetown University. And it's the 30th anniversary of reforms in China that opened up the country. On December 18, 1978, communist leaders met in Beijing to launch policy changes that have dramatically altered the Chinese way of life. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Today's headline here in Southern California is not one we often see. Roads closed due to heavy snow. Well, it's not the only freeze afflicting the state. Today, California put billions of dollars in financing on ice for thousands of road, levee, and school construction projects. It's a story that's playing out across the country as a majority of states face massive budget deficits. Unlike the federal government, states have to balance their budgets. But the cuts needed to make that happen may only make things worse. Marketplace's Sam Eaton has that story.
It's the exact opposite of an economic stimulus plan. California's Alliance for Jobs director Jim Arp says the billions of dollars California is slashing from public works projects boils down to one thing: job cuts, more than 200,000 of them.
It will have a devastating impact on California's economy.
California may not have a choice. The credit market has made bonds hard to come by, leaving a $15 billion hole in the state budget. The casualties are everything from emergency repairs on schools to new carpool lanes on freeways. But that doesn't mean the projects are dead on arrival. Many states hope Obama's economic stimulus package will come to the rescue. The problem with that, says Arp, is that it diverts funds from economic stimulus to maintaining the status quo.
What you're really doing is you're not creating new jobs. You're just basically changing the bank that's paying for the jobs.
And changing the intended nature of those jobs. Obama has promised to use the economic stimulus plan to launch a green job revolution. But Colin Pappard with Friends of the Earth says if those funds are diverted to so-called shovel-ready projects, there may be nothing green about it.
Just because a project is ready to be built doesn't mean it should be built. Maybe some of these projects are actually lying on the cutting room floor for a reason.
At least 37 states are grappling with budget gaps totaling about $66 billion. And Pappard says states have identified a wish list of projects they hope the federal government will fund. But most of those, he says, have to do with expanding highways to make room for more cars. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Michigan is among those states with massive deficits. Last week, the legislature approved $134 million worth of budget cuts. And, of course, the auto industry's woes aren't going away anytime soon. Today, GM suspended work on a new engine plant in Flint as it awaits word on a government bailout. Still no indication from the White House on when help might be forthcoming. There's been a lot of talk about how much it will cost to keep the big three in business. But commentator Robert Reich says there's more on the line than just money.
I'm among those who think there's a good reason to give the big three a $14 billion bridge loan to stave off immediate bankruptcy until they come up with a restructuring plan. But I've got to tell you, I'm deeply troubled by what I hear is the administration's likely decision to give them that bridge loan when just last week Congress said they can't have it. Call me old-fashioned, but I believe in democracy. And under our Constitution, Congress is in charge of appropriating taxpayer money. If Congress explicitly decides not to appropriate it for a certain purpose, where does the White House get the right to do so anyway, by pulling the money out of another bag? That other bag, by the way, called the Troubled Assets Relief Program, or TARP for short, was enacted to rescue Wall Street, not the automobile industry. Now, personally, I think there's more reason to rescue big automakers than big Wall Street banks, but what I want isn't the issue. It's what our representatives voted for. When they voted for TARP in October, they didn't say to the president, here's a $700 billion slush fund to use as you wish. They said, here's $700 billion for Wall Street. If it's a slush fund, everything's arbitrary. I mean, why autos and not, say, state and local governments? They're running short about $100 billion this year, and as a result, are slashing public services, including the nation's schools. Even as it is, TARP is shrouded in secrecy. The Treasury has burned through about $335 billion so far, and no one knows exactly how or by what criteria. Why, for example, did it set tough conditions on some banks while giving Citigroup the sweetest deal imaginable? The dictionary meaning of a TARP is something used to cover things up, which is exactly what we've got. But our system of government depends on sunlight, transparency, public awareness. It also depends on Congress exercising its constitutional duty to make laws and the president executing them. An economic crisis is no excuse for turning our back on democracy.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is Supercapitalism. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. A Mexican government official tells the Associated Press that so far the economic crisis in this country has not sent migrants packing up in droves to go home, at least not officially. So far this year, about 1,800 Mexicans have requested permits to repatriate themselves and their belongings. Meanwhile, some 12 million Mexicans live in the U.S. About half do so illegally. One of them runs a car repair shop in Minneapolis, but his undocumented status has thrown a wrench into his plans. Stephen Smith of American Radio Works has this profile.
Alfredo Flores started fixing flats in this Minneapolis tire shop 11 years ago. He moved here from Mexico and was hungry to learn English. Alfredo knew that was the way to get ahead.
So I started watching movies, a lot of movies, listen to the radio. I don't know the word. I don't know what the word means. And I always ask, how do you say this in present, past, and future? And that's how I learned.
He learned English well. Now Alfredo not only manages the tire shop, he's getting ready to buy it. He feels at home in Minneapolis. He figures he's got at least 300 relatives around town, and a few of them work at the garage. On Saturday afternoons, Alfredo closes the shop and fires up a gas grill in an empty car bay. He cooks pork ribs for employees and friends.
We put lime, salt, and we put the beer on top of it. That's the secret.
There's another secret. Alfredo Flores is in the U.S. illegally. Days after he crossed the border from Mexico, he paid $100 for a fake Social Security number and a bogus green card.
You know, there's a lot of people, they make documents, and we buy them, and that's the only way you can work. I mean, it's not legal, but what can you do?
Alfredo lives with his girlfriend Norma and their two kids. Norma is also in the U.S. illegally. But this couple doesn't fit the stereotype of undocumented workers. They own a three-bedroom house in Minneapolis with a white picket fence. They remodeled their kitchen and built a master suite in the basement.
This is my our jacuzzi.
For so long, life in America seemed stable and promising. The tire business was good, and Norma could stay home with the kids. But late last spring, the police came.
You know, she closed this door right here, and she was in here.
When Minneapolis police broke down the front door, Norma hid in a bathroom closet.
And they came with the gun like this, and, you know, she was scared to death. She was hiding here.
The search warrant said Alfredo might be guilty of identity theft. Unlucky for him, the ID he bought belonged to an IRS agent. Like an estimated 11 million other immigrants, Alfredo used phony papers to work in the U.S. And under Minnesota law, that makes him a criminal. But for now, no charges have been filed.
Well, this is a spicy.
While they wait to see what happens, Norma and Alfredo still eat a big meal together almost every noon. Today, it's hot peppers and pork. Alfredo says his healthy, productive family is an asset to the community, that they're not criminals. To start with, he says, their renovated house is a plus for their neighborhood.
Inside, it was about $55,000. And the outside, $30,000. So I'm kind of supporting the economy, I will say.
Alfredo is also helping support a couple of lawyers. He hired them in case he lands in immigration court. Back at the tire shop, Alfredo says illegal immigrants should be allowed to work in the U.S. as long as they obey the laws and pay their taxes. He's given a lot of thought to how he would change immigration law to help the undocumented.
I will give permission to the people. I mean, I will give them driver license, at least. And maybe some kind of social security card to show that, you know, that, I mean, to collect taxes, because we're willing to pay taxes.
In spite of his legal problems, Alfredo Flores remains optimistic. But he's in legal limbo, either headed for a foothold in the American middle class or headed for deportation back to Mexico. In Minneapolis, I'm Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, Dorothy Gale's ruby slippers may have a place of honor in the Smithsonian, but the newest shoes to shoot to international fame got an offer today of $10 million. A Saudi man said he would pay that sum for the shoes of an Iraqi journalist that he hurled at President Bush last weekend. One slight problem, though, the journalist left the press conference without his size 10s. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 0.1%, 99 points, to close at 8,824. The NASDAQ gave back 0.2%, 10 points, to finish at 1579. And the S&P 500 closed down 0.1%, just over a point, at 911. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Next time on the program, we'll go to work with a Brazilian labor inspector. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.